trying to get this class to decide topics from the congregation that we could consider that would be interesting to discuss. And I'm kind of taking them a little bit in order. I put out, I think, five, this series only lasts 6 weeks. I got six topics. I put out the little, notice that this is what we're going to do. And then I think four topics came in after that. So I said, we'll probably be extending this series into September when we pick up our adult discipleship class again, and I'll pick up some of the other ones. And frankly, I'm being a real wimp about it. Predictably enough, when you ask people for topics, you'll get some basic topics, but then you'll get controversial topics. And you know, I'm as much of a chicken as anyone else about presenting controversial topics. Fortunately, those were the ones that roll in a little bit late. I think that any time you're dealing with topics like this, and usually when I've taught adult classes, it's been exegetical. I've talked out of the Bible. We've taken Bible passages, Bible issues, and just read them up out of the scriptures. But when you're talking about topics, then you're kind of bringing the scriptures to the topics. But as you do that, of course, anybody can add it up just a little bit differently. The answers aren't always clear. And so if you have a controversial topic, I think, well, it doesn't have to be controversial in any kind of vicious or savage way, but it could be something that just doesn't settle real well. And Christians with an honest disposition, a love of God, and a love of the Word of God might arrive at different conclusions. So you say, well, let's make sure when we get to those kind of topics that we're not opinionated. And we have the grace to allow people to believe kind of other things than what I might believe, for example. Let's put limits on that. I am thoroughly orthodox in my Christian faith, orthodox and conservative in my theological beliefs. So it's not like when I'm talking about controversial topics, I'm not talking about things that you would consider heretical or outrageous, that there wouldn't be clear answers on those. Get what I'm saying? Anyway, just keep an open mind. Last week we had one that probably aren't any disagreements on, the Trinity. That was the first one we decided to take on. And I thought it was very interesting. And the big question for us wasn't so much, can we establish it from the scriptures? Because you can do that. It was the question of, does it really matter? What's at stake with this kind of idea? Is it just kind of an intellectual abstraction that doesn't really matter much in the long run as to what happens in people's lives? Or does it have a really vital role to play in our Christian faith? And I was kind of trying to make the case that, yes, it is very vital, that the whole our conception of God needs to be stated very clearly, because not everybody's a Christian there. And they don't start with Christian assumptions. And so how you conceive of deity, God is very much on their mind as to whether they think that Christianity is a viable choice for them. Maybe if you're witnessing to 13-year-olds who grew up in Christian families, then the Trinity gets to be a little bit abstract. But if you're talking to the world at large, you better have a clear idea, well, who is God? What is the nature of God? And be able to explain that. And also that we said that a lot of the other doctrines of the scriptures, of course, depend on the Trinity. Our idea that Jesus goes to the cross and dies on our behalf becomes almost a perverse doctrine if it's not rooted deeply in an understanding of the Trinity. And then we talked about other things. I remember Phil bringing up right away in the class, what happens if Jesus isn't God in the Trinity and we demote him in some way? Well, that has terrible repercussions down the road as to his identity. And that's, of course, a common move in history to somehow or other subordinate Jesus in some way so that you kick the Trinity out of the picture. Well, it was fun. I love talking about that kind of stuff. So this week, the topic that came in to talk about was about tithing and giving. Thought, well, there's nothing controversial about that because nobody ever argues about money, right? Yeah, it was a real easy one, open and shut case, isn't it? It's very interesting when Keith read his passages this morning, and he had the one from the sower, and the deceitfulness of wealth, I think, was how the NIV translated. I've been a Christian a long time, and for some reason that part of the thorns that choke us has never really impressed itself upon me. I don't know, maybe because I've never had any money, the worries of this life part of it just sort of wiped out the deceitfulness of wealth, or riches. I think the term deceitfulness just really grabbed me when you were reading it. I thought, money is such a trickster. Isn't it? I mean, it's just always just, it's like a trickster God, you know, that you don't quite know how it's going to play or land itself in your life. When you don't have it, you want it, and when you've got it, you want to keep it, and you don't know how to give it, and it's an amazingly slippery subject, isn't it, money? I mean, it can eat you. It can really, I don't know, I think it's intriguing. Anyway, so let's talk about tithing and giving in the Christian life. First of all, what is it? Secondly, what does the Bible teach about it? And in particular, what does the Bible sort of require, or should we say expect, of Christians in regard to giving? And what does it achieve in the life of a believer? You know, it'd be nice to be the recipient of the giving, but what does it do for the giver? So what is tithing? Let's start with that one. That was how the question came to me.
Tithing. What is tithing? I heard it say it's 10% of your income.
By definition, it's one-tenth. One-tenth. You know, that's what it is. If you're using the word tithe to refer to anything else, you're kind of off the biblical word base there. There's giving, and then there's tithing. There are offerings, and there's tithing. But tithing is always definitionally 10%. In terms of Bible studies, that works in both Greek and Hebrew, one-tenth. The English word tithe, that's an English word. It doesn't show any root down to the Hebrew or the Greek. That's another word that means one-tenth of things. It's giving 10%. So you need a precision in vocabulary. People would make if you heard the term, or the way things get linked, tithes and offerings. And so some people will make a great deal that there's sort of a required level of tithes. That's just, you know, you give that. And then offering is sort of your abundance that you give beyond that, and that would be your offering. So some people make such a thing. What's the Bible say about it? Two cognate words are used, New Testament and Old Testament. How many times do you suppose the word tithe is used in the New Testament? Tithe or when I say a cognate word, it's like tithes, tithing, you know, a word that's sort of a form of the same word, but it's got the same foundation. Take a wild guess. How many times is that said in the New Testament, that word?
I'm going to guess three.
Three? I'm taking votes here, so.
70.
Zero? Did you say zero? 70? We've got quite a range going here. All right, and some people are tongue-tied, right? Anybody else want to vote?
$1.
$1? All right, who's leaning towards the extreme of, you said zero, right, Phil? All right, how many are like saying, I'm leaning Phil's direction here? Yeah, one, two, three. Yeah, it's a weak affirmation for your position, Phil. I'm sorry. Okay, we've got another one on the table now, so you're messing up my vote. Who's going to lean to? Who said 70? Was you, Joe? Joe says 70. Who's leaning towards 70?
Oh.
Nobody. Okay, you're in trouble. You'll never win this election. The poll numbers are against you. Who said 10? Somebody said 10.
Probably less than 10.
Less than 10. Okay, Tasha's about correct. It's used seven times. There's a cognate type word for tithe, the idea of giving 10. Two times, it's cast in a completely negative kind of light. It's about the Pharisees. You can see it in Luke 11:42. By the way, I always ask people to open Bibles and read verses to us so we can get the references and educate ourselves from the scriptures. So there are two parallel passages, one in Matthew, one in Luke. But you'd say this is two of the uses I say are just kind of negative about tithing. Could you somebody read us Luke 11:42? Could you all hear that? I'm sorry, could you belt it out, read it one more time, just like.
Because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God, You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone.
Ah, thank you. Thanks for reading it out louder again, too. You started, I think, before anybody even really knew you were starting, so they weren't clued in on you, and they would have heard it otherwise. Well, that's kind of negative, right, against the Pharisees. You say you're tithing on all your herbs and spices, but you've left undone weightier matters of justice. But I think the interesting thing about that is the tense he uses. You should have. The context, of course, is in the context of their Jewish faith. They should have tithed and should have continued to keep in mind God's justice. In the midst of this, and not neglect this, shouldn't have pulled those two apart. The other four, another four occasions of the use of the tithe are actually very historical, and they even precede Jewish law in a sense, and they all occur in the book of Hebrews. Really, it seems to us Hebrews 7:5-9. Would somebody take a look at those? And read them when you get there.
Now the law requires the descendants of Levi, who become priests, to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their fellow Israelites, even though they also are descended from Abraham. This man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. And without doubt, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In the one case, the tenth is collected by people who die, but in the other case, by him who is declared to be living. One may even say that Levi, who collects the tenth, paid the tenth through Abraham, because when Melchizedek met Abraham, Levi was still in the body of his ancestor.
Anybody cross-eyed yet? Is that a difficult passage to follow? Well, it's very interesting because it starts with the law builds itself on something that precedes the law by hundreds of years, by centuries. We go back to the story of Abraham paying a tithe to Melchizedek. You know this story from and Melchizedek's this very mysterious figure, of course, in the Old Testament. Exactly who is he, and why is Abraham paying tithes to him? The book of Hebrews, you know, mentions this is something of a type of Jesus, but there's little to go on when you read the story in Genesis. But then it elaborates even beyond that to say that Levi, who's Levi? What is he in relationship to Abraham?
He's one of the first priests.
Yeah, you have to go way down into the tribal list, right? I mean, the Levites are one of the tribes of Israel, so Levi himself would be a grandson of Abraham, right? And then they become very important, of course, in the law and things like that. But they're saying that passage in Hebrew gets even more cosmic and weird because it's saying Levi paid tithes through Abraham till Melchizedek and things like that. And you think, wow, that's a complicated little passage to be reading there. But it's an historical allusion, and it's not at all about giving or money exactly, is it? And when you read it, you're dropping into kind of another kind of positions about trying to identify Jesus. It's about the identity of Jesus more than about any kind of money. Well, so we've got, we just looked at kind of like the words tithing keep appearing there, but these are those few appearances of the word tithing in New Testament. Since the word appears so infrequently in the New Testament, what do we draw from this? I mean, from a Bible interpretation standpoint. The priority seems to be low in the New Testament on this issue of tithing. So it's very interesting because a lot of Christians make a big deal of that particular topic, but they can't draw a lot out of the New Testament that will explain it to them. So where do they go? Well, you go to the Hebrew Scriptures, right? And we see that it does have kind of foundations that even precede the Jewish law, that go way back into the story of Abraham and other things like that. So let's just look at some of those and just sort of see, well, what's the foundation of this tithing? The Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures have a lot to say about tithing, and of course it becomes a written into the Jewish law as kind of an expectation. So it's very ancient. As I said, it precedes the law. That passage that we referred to in Hebrews that was so hard to follow is actually in Genesis 14:20. Would somebody just read 14:20 to us? I think it'll be a little more narrative and clear. It won't be developing the big argument that the book of Hebrews is. So somebody read us Genesis 14, verse 20.
And praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand, and Abraham gave him the tenth of Abraham.
Yep. That's the Melchizedek, king of Salem, and the one that's the passage that Hebrews riffs off of. We'll see it in Genesis 23:20 with Jacob, too. Would somebody read that to us? Genesis 23:20.
So the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site.
Uh-oh. Is that
23:20?
I thought so. And that's what you got, huh? I reverse numbers a lot. I wonder what chapter I was trying to get you to. I'll never recreate it now, but it is Jacob. Let me just rehearse it and forget my terrible ability. I've inherited this from my mother. You know, if you give me a phone number, I turn numbers around. So probably some combination of those numbers will turn into the right reference. But I'm kind of, you know, dyslexia, but I've got it with numbers. I mess up a lot with them. So anyway, Jacob's promising that he will give a tenth if God will bless him. That's when he's off to go. He's fleeing from Esau and things like that. He promised he'll give a tenth of everything he owns if he can survive this. But remember, you're looking back into that patriarchal period. The Jewish faith, as it's understood from Sinai on, it hasn't appeared yet. There's no priesthood, no temple, no law given. Actually, the content of religious life in that patriarchal period is, we don't know much about it. I mean, they did stuff. They had some sense of morality, but the law is way down the road from Abraham and Jacob, and you just see things that are already in place but or sort of developing, but you don't know the details. It gets into the law, though. When Moses gets the law, and we'll read it from Deuteronomy. Would somebody read us Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 23, and I'll keep my fingers crossed. Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 23.
You shall tithe all the yield of your seed that comes from the field year by year and before the Lord your God in the place that he will choose to make his name dwell there. You shall eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, of your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and flock, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always.
Now, there's a lot in those verses about tithing in the Old Testament, or in the Hebrew Scriptures. First of all, what are we tithing? First, what's the first element?
Crops.
Seeds. Now, that crops. What do we already have an issue with as Christians in the 21st century?
Most people don't have crops.
Keith's garden is covered with wheat. Probably looks better than mine does usually. Well, isn't it interesting? What does this say about the general social settings of the Hebrew Scriptures versus a modern Christian situation? It's not a cash economy. I mean, so it's going to have issues as you try to apply it to cash economies where people are dealing with money, because that's not what they dealt with or the way they thought about it. And actually, this becomes a big thing. If you know anything about Jewish faith, there's the Talmud and the Mishnah in particular. And this really is the elaboration of all the rabbis about you know, what to do with things. One of the It breaks it into six categories, and the law into six categories, and has big elaborations. What do you do? What does this mean? How do you apply it, these laws? And one of those subdivisions is seeds. You know, how do you do this? I mean, what does it transfer? I heard a Christian Jewish rabbi, if you will, talk about saying any concept of tithing that's like 10% of your cash just doesn't match well what's going on in the Hebrew scriptures. He said, probably it would move to closer to 30% of your wealth in terms of your resources. And he said, so be very cautious about being righteous, about declaring 10% of your income as being what the Jews practice, because it probably didn't work out the same way. There's something else that's really weird in the passage you read, though, in Deuteronomy 14, about the tithe, which is, what do they do with this thing?
They eat it.
So let's take the offering this morning, and I'll go out to lunch. Who's with me? We probably do all right, or maybe we couldn't. I don't know. Maybe that would be a great experiment once a year, just at random, to take the offering and say, let's spend it on ourselves, and we'll see. You know, that wasn't a very good offering, was it? You know, I got French fries. What did you get? Well, it's very interesting that they consume it themselves, that part of the tithe. And one of the really things that really troubles the people is that they can spend it on wine and strong drink, whatever their heart desires. Strong drink is, of course, distilled liquor. They didn't know how to distill it back then, but they could kind of, as I understand, super ferment stuff. I'm sorry, I don't drink alcohol, by the way. I don't think it's a sin, but I don't. Put it that way. Wasn't that interesting when we look at the tithing in the law like that? In Deuteronomy 26, 12 through 15, would somebody read that? Deuteronomy 26, 12 through 15. Once again, I'll cross my fingers and hope I got you your numbers right.
When you have finished setting aside a tenth of all your produce in the third year, the year of the tithe, you shall give it to the Levite, the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat in your towns and be satisfied. Then say to the Lord your God, I have removed from my house the sacred portion and have given it to the Levite, the foreigner, the fatherless, the widow, according to all you have commanded. I have not turned aside from your commands, nor have I forgotten any of them.
Right. So the third year tithe was a really big, big element, as I understand it, and the rabbis discussed that a lot. But whereas in the first passage we were eating it ourselves, what's happening to this tithe? It's what? To whom, that is?
The Levite, the foreigner, and the fatherless, and the widow.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The Levites, who were they at this point? Remember, they paid tithes to Melchizedek through Abraham. You know? So who are the Levites in this context? Yeah. They work in the temple. I mean, some of them will be priests, some of them won't be. But the idea is, of course, that's part of the religious, you might say, cultus of the Jews. I mean, this is what keeps temple tabernacle running. You know, these people, remember, don't have a portion in the land. They are dependent on the other tribes to support them so that they can run the religion of the temple, the tabernacle, the Jewish faith. So in a sense, this is like support of your pastor, so to speak, you know, in one sense. But then the other thing is, you're not eating it, you're giving it to the poor and the disadvantaged and people like that, people who are in need, the widows and things like that. There's a lot of discussion as to why this is every third year, and is that just because when you deal with a non-cash economy, this doesn't figure out every year. The third year becomes kind of almost like a corrective. Make sure at that point you have done so much. Well, it continues to develop in the law, and you get a very famous passage that is often quoted when churches want to beat you and tell you to give more money. That's probably inappropriate, I'm sorry. No, I'm not. Malachi 3. Let's look at that. Tell me about the book of Malachi.
Last book of the Old Testament.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're struggling to find it, it's the last book of the Old Testament, the English Old Testament. That doesn't work that way in the Hebrew Bible. But yeah, it's the last book in our English Bibles. And it is the last book chronologically, it would seem, if you don't have a Catholic Bible. And there's about 400 years that'll jump between the book of Malachi and the book of, Matthew, if you will. that's the intertestamental period. So the second temple's built. Judaism is once again in a situation in which it's trying to develop its own powers, and Malachi speaks into that. And he's in particular, God is speaking to them that the Jews are being cheap about supporting the religion and building up their own nation. One of the things they're doing, remember, if you're to have a lamb or an animal and sacrifice it, it's supposed to be without pure and without blemish. Remember, we talked about this during the Passover. You know, it'd hold the Passover for 4 days to examine them to make sure that they were a perfect animal. But apparently, they'd gotten this bright idea that they would take the lesser animals and, the blind, the lame, the ones that they didn't need to reproduce, they'd use those for their sacrifices. And God through Malachi is all about saying, give these to your governor, see how he likes that, you should be doing better by me. But would somebody read us Malachi 3, 8 through 10?
Will a mere mortal rob God if you rob me? But you ask, how are we robbing you? In tithes and offerings.
I said 8 through 10.
Oh, okay. You are under a curse, your whole nation, because you are robbing me. Bring the whole tithe into a storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that there will not be room enough to store it.
Okay, very good. Well, that passage gives us as I said, I mean, it gets pulled out, doesn't it? Things aren't going well. You're robbing God if you don't tithe. Go ahead and tithe, and God will open heaven and pour out these blessings on you. And don't expect them to come unless you do it. Now, obviously, that can be drawn out and pulled out into perverse territory pretty easily. So let's just hold it for a moment. Hold that and come back to it, but this is the question. Should Christians tithe? You'll hear this,
of course.
And you will hear a sermon from time to time that if you don't, you're robbing God, and expect nothing good to come out of that.
Yes, they should tithe.
Think so?
Yes,
they do.
They will. He's a God that's changed not. He's a God that's changes not. He set up an order. And if you're going to have a house, how can you take care of it unless those that come together to eat in within that house provide so that there's provisions for the house?
That's what we
have. Seems to me that one of the things that Jesus did when he talked about the law, he didn't say, the law is worthless anymore, but he tended to say, you've heard it was said this very specific physical thing that I say to you, and he takes the principle behind it or the spiritual aspect of it and applies that. And I wonder if maybe something like that has happened or is happening with the tithe, where it's not so much this many seeds and that many goats, but what is the principle, the idea, the spirit behind the tithe?
Very much like the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard it said of those of old time, but I say unto you, and always going to the spirit of things. Well, this leads us to a really interesting kind of Bible interpretation idea, which is how much of the Old Testament do we import, or shall we export or import, depending on which one you're studying, into our Christian faith? Does it hold us down? So it's been common for Christians to assume this one carries over. And they have different ways of justifying that, of course, and one of them might be that it actually seems to precede the law, so that it, maybe it's sort of in a different category of its own, some kind of maybe cosmic register that, you know, the way God sets things up. Or don't you bring it forward at all? So, I mean, we've already seen a juxtaposition here. I will say this before we continue with it, that we stand in a tradition, that this church tradition we stand in, the one I'm ordained in, is probably one of the most extreme in terms of only using the New Testament and only bringing forward out of the Old Testament those things for which there is a specific warrant in the New Testament. In other words, if the New Testament grabs it and says, put this down here, we do it. If it doesn't, we've tended to leave it out. You can go other places in the Christian community where, well, of course, they put a priority on the New Testament and the life of Jesus, but they're a little more, you'll get this particularly with Calvinists. And I'm not saying that as cheap slander. I'm not a Calvinist, but I mean, you'll get it that they have a different view of the relationship of the old covenant with the new covenant, and so they're a little more willing to sort of use the models of the old covenant in their Christian faith. This Mennonite world we live in has been pretty radical about not doing that, you know, not interpreting the Bible that way. Yeah.
Doesn't Paul set a precedence in how the church order is when he talks about, in many, many times, about, he talks to the church about bringing in and taking care of those in charge? Although he says he goes out and he works for his own so that none can say that they have support him. At the same time, he encourages them to give, not only for their church, but in others, send to other churches that are in need.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you're dead on there. I mean, the absence of verses that specifically use the word tithe in the New Testament, but the concept of giving in the New Testament and generosity is incredibly, the balance is that way, towards giving, towards generosity. So we haven't gotten to those yet. I'm asking this question of tithing, though, because that was the question that was asked to me for this class, is what about tithing? Well, this is the question. If we should tithe, this is the cold reality of it. We don't tithe. We simply don't. Let me read different things. People study this, of course, fundraisers and people who want money. I mean, it simply doesn't happen. It is alarming that Christians now give less per capita than during the Great Depression. If you're young, you don't know about the Great Depression. It's different than the Great Recession and, you know, and 2008. My parents were in the Great Depression. You know, people were really, really hurting, you know. But Christians gave more. When we finally look at those in church, at best, 25% of the congregation give. Only a quarter of the people in the church are giving at all. So right there, I mean, as a broad statistic, you get that. That's at best. If you have that level of participation, you're not in the norm. According to other research, it says only 3 to 5% actually tithe in most cases. 3 to 5%. And it's not the wealthy. Statistics suggest that if you make less than $20,000, you're 8 times more likely to give than someone who makes $75,000. I'm fascinated by that kind of statistic. You look at the rich and famous, and every once in a while pop out, how much money did they give to charity? And it's kind of frightening when you think of how much money some people have, but how little of it gets given away. And then you get some real exceptions. People are really, really broad and generous with it, but it's a remarkable statistic. Here's another one. That came from sharefaith.com. That's this comes from nonprofitquarterly.org. I tried to find, I'm a librarian among other things, I try to get good sources for you, so I don't think I'm just pulling some 15-year-old's blog from New Jersey, you know, on giving. You know, I've tried to get you good statistics here. January 31st, 2011, Christianity Today. How much of your income do you devote to charitable giving? According to EmptyTomb.org, Christians donated 2.43% of their income in 2008. That's less than 3% of their income. Down from 2.57 in 2007. Isn't that interesting? Because that was, wasn't 2008 the Great Recession? I mean, that's when the bottom falls out of our modern economy. Evangelicals, now, so we're going to divide it from churchgoers. We'll take the kind of like, but what about the real Bible-believing Christians? You know, as much as you can find those in the evangelical church, they give 4%. There are solid proportions. These are solid proportions compared to all Americans, but much less than 10%. I remember years ago when our denominations, the Mennonites, were big on stewardship seminars and things like that. I think they were saying that typically in Mennonite churches it's about 5%. So we were more righteous than those poor 4% sinners. Barna.com. Among born-again Christians, which includes both evangelicals and non-evangelicals, 12%, tithed in 2012. Which is on par with the average for the past decade. So you see some variation in who's counting the beans, so to speak, you know, and what kind of percentages you get. The National Association of Evangelicals, those giving 10% in 1968, let's see, 5.98%, 1985, 4.71%, 2014,
3.20%.
So, what's the moral of the story? We don't tithe. if you say Christians ought to tithe, then the simple, we could probably end the class with the, we don't do it. We just don't do it. I'm still holding my opinion back on all this. Let's just look at
some passages on giving
and try to feed on those as we look at this. One of the great ones, of course, is Luke chapter 12 and starting, I think, in verse 32. And could somebody read us Luke 12, 32 through 34?
Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourself that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
I think this is more the New Testament approach to this. Don't be afraid. Sell what you have and give alms. A generous disposition,
if you will.
Somebody read us 2 Corinthians 9 through 7. 9, 7.
Excuse me. 2 Corinthians
chapter 9, verse 7.
Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth the cheerful giver.
Yeah, do you know anything funny about that verse? I mean, it's unusual about that verse? Do you have a red letter, does anybody have a red letter Bible?
Or anything
like that? Do they put God loves the cheerful giver in red or anything? I've seen it that way, but in fact, there's no scriptural verse that says that. This comes completely from Paul, but it looks like a quotation when he says it, like it's being quoted from things, but it isn't. God loves a cheerful giver, not under constraint, but cheerfully. Let's look at Luke 21:2. We're talking about giving in the New Testament. This makes for an interesting thing. It's very easy to think, evaluate it in completely monetary terms, but 21, 1 through 2, I think it is, no, 3.
Jesus looked up, and he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in 2 very small copper coins. Truly, I tell you, he said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put all she had to live on.
If you were kind of developing a lesson for people out of that, what would you say about it?
It's obviously not about the denomination on the coin that you give. I mean, it's not about the monetary amount. It's about the attitude of your heart. Yeah, if she had tithed all of a tenth of what she had, it would have been much less than what she gave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says so many things to me. That set of verses. It reminds me of Bono and U2. My God is not short of cash. It's not to be seen in monetary terms. I mean, who knows what the widow's coins achieve, but apparently in terms of her, it's a much more noble act. She's giving even what she would live on otherwise. Let's look at one more of these. Let's see, Luke 21:3. No, that's the one we just read. Let's see. Uh-oh. I've done it to myself once again with my numbers. Sorry. I'll find this for you because I think it's a really classic set of verses we want to look at.
Luke 6:38.
Yes. How do you know? I had 38 there. But I didn't put the chapter down, so I assumed it was from the Sermon on the Plain. But you have to watch it, because Luke goes back to that same stuff in Luke chapter 12. So I was quickly scanning Luke 12 to make sure it was supposed to be in 6. Thank you. Would somebody read us 6:38, that whole little section there. You'll see where it's supposed to end. 6:38.
Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you.
Give and it will be given to you. All right. So, once again, what do we think about the state of our giving?
Our current state?
Yeah. Okay. That's our treasurer speaking, by the way. Myron, you look like you're about to say something. Oh, okay. It just looked like you were about to make a point. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Well, it's probably pretty bad, isn't it? My view of this, I said I was going to hold my opinion. I don't believe Christians should be required to tithe 10% of their income. I don't think the New Testament does that, but I'm very much in our school of thinking about how you apply the Old Covenant in the New Covenant. But I'm very much with Jesse, the idea that actually generosity, the spirit of it, is what matters the most, that Christ wants to bring out of us. And for some people, tithing would probably be somewhat irresponsible, although I think that when we look at the story of the widow, I think it's proper to give even when it hurts and maybe even seems irresponsible to the world's eyes. But I think there are probably people in situations in life where they're not tithing is not a robbery of God. They've got families, little children, they've got stresses on their income. They shouldn't have to think of this mechanical 10%. On the other hand, I would think there would be other people who ought to be looking at their bank account and saying, I need to give a whole lot more than 10%. I have much more than that. And I think that's where the Spirit of Jesus would be speaking to them in all that. So I think the idea is to be generous, open-handed, to want to share what you have with others. Tithing for me, if I may just speak personally, was something of a developmental phase. It was a very good disciplinary practice for a while in life to just do that. But it comes to a point where it seems legalistic. And I think you might find if you kind of quit doing it that way, you might find that you're more generous than you were when you were doing it that way. And you might find pleasant surprises down the road. It just took a little bit to get on that page for me. One of them were little kids coming to my door. We just decided that when little kids come to selling candy bars, unless they're doing it for a cult group or something, we'll buy the popcorn, we'll buy the candy bar. I don't care about their little league, but hey, there's little tykes out there selling chocolate bars.
I care about their little league.
Well, I do too. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, but I'm not like a, you know, I'm not like the neighborhood boost or anything like that. But I just thought, I just want to be open-handed. I just want to be that person, and it made a big difference. I've known people do the same with people on the street. We don't have a lot of beggars in the street, but if you live in other countries, you can get a lot of them. I've known people say, well, I'm going to give them something. You know, it might not be everything I have to live on, but I'm not going to walk past people holding out their hand for money. I don't do that, but I've known people who've done that. This leads us to that issue of the prosperity gospel, which is you give so you can get. In other words, this idea of the Malachi goes to seed, so to speak, and the idea is that, well, if you give, then God's going to open up heaven and pour riches in your lap. I'm delighted to say I'm out of time. And I think that's totally irresponsible and false, and I quit. So, but I don't have time to go into it. You want to join me in a prayer? Heavenly Father, as we go from here this morning, I pray we'd be fed by the prayers, by the songs Katie picked, that we wouldn't fear. I pray we'd be, Roseanne, I'm sorry. Maybe you both picked them. I don't know. Keith's sermon, Lord, blessed us, and I pray the words that he brought from Scriptures would feed us and carry us through the week. And I pray that these passages we've looked at would move us in our hearts to be generous and open-handed and to give freely and to just be the kind of people who are not attached to the deceitfulness of wealth, but instead see the power and the blessing of giving to others. Please go with us then. In Jesus' name, amen.